You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we're joined in studio by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman. Hello, Alan.
I wouldn't go that far, Kester. I would not go that far. Hi, Kester. Hi, Sophia. How are we?
Pretty good this week.
We're still meant to be on holiday at the moment.
It's
a day off.
Yeah, I would certainly appreciate another day. However, we're in the studio right now, and we've got
Absolutely.
A heap of interesting things to talk about. This 100-year-old milk powder.
Yeah.
In Antarctica.
Yeah, which is kind of interesting, really, because sort of begs the question, what did people eat back in the day and how does it compare with what we eat now? And, you know, I very much doubt that you'd be keen on sampling something that's been in a tin for 100 years.
No, I wouldn't drink milk from a month ago even.
Oh, I hear you. So it's interesting in this respect because some workers at Fonterra have just published a paper in a journal called the Journal of Dairy Science, and they were lucky enough to lay their hands on an at least 100-year-old tin of dried milk.
Mm.
And this comes from the Shackleton expedition of 1908, where he wanted to be the first to go to the Antarctic or go to the South Pole. And he got to within 180 kilometres of it and then very sensibly turned back, which you'd be gutted, wouldn't you? You go all that way, you get to within 180K, which, you know, it's not a heck of a long way, and then you turn back.
First person to get 180 metres away from the South Pole doesn't quite ring.
But anyway, so he stocked up in New Zealand on his way to...
Wise move.
And apparently the boat had only about a metre of freeboard on it, so I was reading, which that was a heavily laden boat. Anyway, amongst all that stuff on the boat, there was 450 kg of dried milk powder, all in tins, made in New Zealand. And so... what he did, obviously, as they all did in those days when they went down to Antarctica, you build a base camp and everything, you build a hut, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you put all of those things in your hut. And it so happened that there was a tin of this milk powder that was discovered in the hut around about 100 years later. Mm. And they were a bit sort of, they weren't definite on the dates, so I'm not quite sure when it was discovered, but... anyway, it's at least 100 years old, this
right.
stuff. So
wow.
These folk at Fonterra thought, wow, okay, so, you know, here's some milk powder from 100 years ago, which has been kept, very importantly, at less than 0 degrees, you know. Mm. So it's basically been frozen for 100 years.
Mm.
So we're not going to have any problems with decomposition and stuff like that. So why don't we analyse it using our, you know, techniques that we've got these days, modern day techniques, and see whether or not it's basically the same stuff. So in those days, to make milk powder, what they would do was basically evaporate boiling milk. And, oh, my God, if there's one thing I can't stand, it's hot milk. I just...
Really?
Oh, it gets that skin on the top of it, and it just makes me gag. Ugh, just even thought of that, yuck. But that's the way that they did it on large scale. So they'd pour this boiling milk onto big rollers or something, and it would evaporate away, and you get this thin skin of... dried milk. And nowadays they do it under much milder conditions, so they don't have to heat it up, so they just basically use spray, so essentially spray evaporation, so into fine particles, etc., 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 and that evaporates much more quickly, and they use vacuums as well, and so that lowers the boiling point and everything, and etc., etc. So long story short, they did the analysis and basically they found that, you know, pretty much the fundamentals in there are pretty much the same. So you're looking at the same sort of fats and the same roughly amount of fats, and you're looking at the same proteins and the same amount of proteins, et cetera, et cetera. All of that good stuff that's, you know, in milk powder. And so basically the take-home message was, this stuff from 100 years old sort of measures up well to today's stuff. The one big thing that they did notice was that in Shackleton's sample, they had quite a bit of, dare I say it, lead and iron and tin.
Right.
Which is not the best.
No.
But presumably came from the tin can and very possibly the lead solder that that they used in those days. And if you haven't heard of this story, there's about the Franklin expedition to find the Northwest Passage in about 1850, something like that. And they just lost everybody. They and they only just discovered the ships like a couple of years ago. Mm. But they found some bodies, and basically what they reckon was that it was the lead solder in the cans of food that killed them. They all died of lead poisoning, basically, because this was a very new technology.
Yeah, what an awful way to go out.
No, that's a good story if you've heard of that. Right. So there you go. So 100-year-old milk, pretty much the same as modern-day milk.
Mm, all right. Yeah. Moving on a little bit to climate change and affecting the Earth's rotation.
Yeah, yeah. Gosh, all these weird things that you learn doing this that I might otherwise not look up, which, you know, it's fascinating. So I'm learning just as much as everyone else with all of these things. So everyone's used to the fact that every 4 years we add on a leap day, and which we had this year, because we're divisible by four and it's not ending in a 0-0 and therefore divisible by 400. All that, you know, all the rules for having a leap day. And we do that because it takes the Earth 365 and a quarter days to go around the sun, basically. So every 4 years you make up that one day. Now, what's not quite so well known is the fact that the Earth's rotation on its axis also is just a wee bit variable, okay? Mm. So it's not absolutely constant. Mm. And things like, in fact, earthquakes, like the massive earthquake that bore the tsunami in 2004.
Right.
That apparently altered the rate of rotation of the Earth. Not by very much. We're not talking a heck of a lot. But there seems to be some sort of variation of, you know, in the order of a second or so. Mm. And so since 1972, and the fact that we can measure time so ridiculously accurately now, they found it necessary since 1972 to add leap seconds now. Mm. Okay, so I remember at the end of 1 year listening to RNZ or something like that, and, you know, had the pips beep.
Yeah.
They had an extra pip, you know. there was the leap second. And they need to do this because of the natural variation in the Earth's rotation, okay?
Right.
And since 1972, they've added 27 leap seconds. So they don't do it every year. Mm. They just do it when it's basically necessary, okay? Now, what they found is that the interior of the Earth, the liquid core, apparently is rotating a little bit more slowly now, which means that the outside is rotating a little bit faster. So the crust and everything that we're on rotates a little bit faster. And so they had figured out that probably in 2006, what they're going to have to do is to take a second off. Okay, ooh, so it sort of do a reverse leap second, okay, because of that. But then this guy, Duncan Angue from Scripps Institute in the States, he has come along and said, oh, hang on, we haven't taken into account the fact that the polar ice caps are melting. And in fact, that is also having an enormous effect, you know, well, you know, relatively speaking, on the rotation of the Earth. And so instead of very possibly having to take a second off in 2026, now, because of this extra contribution from the melting ice caps, we might not have to do that till 2029, 2030, they're thinking.
So, and it sort of cancels out.
It's sort of, but, you know, that's the really important thing, is that, hell, this is having an effect on how fast the Earth rotates, you know. Fascinating stuff. And this is a very unusual paper. He's just published this in Nature, and it's a single author paper, which means it's all his own work. You know, it's very, very unusual that you get something of this importance or this magnitude that's just done by one person. So very, very interesting stuff, and something, again, I had really no idea about.
Yeah. So. And then lastly, you've got here something perhaps of a little bit more relevance to our listeners. About not saying that seconds in the year aren't interesting, of course, but I'm sure we've got a whole bunch of people very opinionated about this one song lyrics becoming more repetitive.
Yes, indeed. Look, now, how do you get a gig like this? How do you get a university position where you think, oh, heck, I am going to study 353,320 English language songs for their lyric content?
Jeez.
basically, and get paid for it. I mean, come on. And so this is what a bunch of workers in Austria have just done. So they wanted to see, basically, if there are any trends in lyrics over the past 50 years. And so they went to Last FM, and they got these 353,320 song lyrics. And they basically went through them and they were analyzing them in terms of their lexical, their linguistic, their structural, their rhyme, their emotion, and their complexity. And how you put numbers on that and everything like that, I'm not really quite sure. But there's lots of graphs in the paper, lots of graphs, straight lines, all that sort of thing. And so what they were looking at, so they're looking at five major types of music. So it was rap, it was country, pop, R&B, and rock. Okay, and so they figured those being the five major. And so they were splitting up all of the lyrics of the songs into those sections and stuff. And basically, the long and the short of it is that, yes, that they think that the lyrics have become simpler over the past 50 years with respect to things like vocabulary richness, readability, complexity, and the number of repeated lines. So... So obviously things are getting less complex, the number of repeated lines are getting more, the vocabulary richness is getting less, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And another thing, and again, no surprises probably, the lyric, you do the research and just confirming everybody's biases, but the lyrics have become more negative and more personal. And it's all I now. And honestly, that's one of the first... I really don't listen to music radio, you know, not really. But, you know, if you do happen to sort of catch it, it is. It's all I. I don't know. I'm so good and I did this. And, that. And I'm sounding like an old fogey here. But that's just my, you know, personal opinion. So, and the final thing was that apparently the rock listeners like lyrics from old songs, surprise, surprise, and country music listeners like lyrics from new songs, which is a little bit surprising.
A little bit surprising.
But then, you know, putting numbers on all of this sort of stuff, and it's very, very subjective, I would have thought. You know, it's a very, very subjective thing to, you know, to say, well, what's a negative lyric, you know, or you know, what's a readable, you know, what's the vocabulary richness in this particular song, and blah blah blah, and oh boy, I don't know, but you know, they're on a good gig here anyway, you know, and so
yeah, I'm sure they're making their money's worth out of it, listening to songs all day, writing down a few notes here and there. Seems like the dream.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So yeah, if anybody's interested in that.
Yeah, and those will be linked in the podcasted episode later on today. All right, finishing up Dear Science now. Thank you, Alan, for coming on today.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Moshat.
Yes.
And thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Moshat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.